hello. Welcome to the Five By. You're not overstaying its welcome while still not being a fair weather friend source for brief but potent board game reviews. In this episode, Meeple Lady shares her thoughts about how physics impacts static posing cats of various sizes in Boop. Geraldine will be providing some feedback on a roll and write where tagging and polyominoes meet in Tag City. Ben experiences a solo game based on the last days of World War II in Castle Itter, the strangest battle of World War II. I'll be telling you whether or not the game Trio is Goldfish the Next Generation, Goldfish Enterprise, or something else entirely different. But first you will hear Justin's thoughts on the deck construction, deck building, flag capturing game Challengers Beach Cup. Oh wait, there is an exclamation point. Let me try that again. Challengers? That sounds more like it's a question. Challengers Beach Cup. Yeah, I guess that'll have to do.
Hey gang, Justin Bell here with the 5x. One of my favorite party games of the last few years recently birthed a sequel. Maybe expand-alone is the proper term, since Challengers Beach Cup, also known in my household as Challengers 2, is an expansion to the Challengers base game, and it's a standalone game that does not require any of the base game's components. I'm a big fan of expand-alones, and I'm a big fan of Challengers Beach Cup. If you're a fan of the base game, great news. Not much has changed. Designed like the base game by Johannes Krenner and Marcus Slowiczek, Challengers Beach Cup pits 1 to 8 players against each other in a deck-building version of the classic card game War. During each of the game's 7 rounds, players will draw and select new cards to add to an ever-changing deck that features cards that will fight it out in a game of capture the flag at a nearby park represented by a colorful neoprene mat. Each card has a power value that will be used to attack or defend against a single opponent at the other end of your mat. These cards are top-decked, one at a time, until the power value exceeds the total of the opponent's current flag holder. When that happens, the defeated party moves all cards in their stack to their bench. The bench has 6 seats, but here's the fun part. Each seat can only hold a single card type. That means if you have a card titled Newcomer, each and every card in your deck titled Newcomer sits in the same seat on your bench. Now that's important, because when the bench fills up and a player needs to add another card to a full bench, that player automatically loses the game. Players can also lose if they need to draw a card to attack their opponent, but don't have any left. This also means that the game heavily prioritizes finding cards in the draw deck with identical names, because they can share a seat on the bench. The winner of each round gets a trophy, with a certain number of points, known as fans, that will count at the end of the 7th round. When all 7 rounds are done, each player counts up their fans, and in a 3-8 player game, the 2 players with the most fans duke it out in a park for winner-takes-all bragging rights. The main addition to the expand-alone game is the addition of trainers. Trainers give each player an ongoing player power, or a once-per-round power that, in my experience, can be situationally game-breaking. Combined with some of the cards in Challengers Beach Cup, this adds a nice wrinkle that can be added or removed with ease, even with new players. I think trainers are a bit much in a game where each card has its own unique power, so I used the trainers once and kept them in the box for future plays. But I like that they're here for the Challengers superfan in your life. I like the Challengers system quite a bit, in part because it scales so well. You can play this solo, with a bot player that is surprisingly effective thanks to the game's Automa rules. You can play this with 6-8 players and have a great, shouty time that usually wraps up in about an hour. You can play with an odd number of players using the bot that plays against each player at least once. And, thanks to the magic of the expand-alone, a copy of both the base game and this expansion accommodate 16 players at once, just in case your game night is more massive than most. Now, Challengers is not perfect, especially in the eyes of a player that sees this as only a version of War with a lot of luck built into the card draw. Frankly, that's how I felt after my first couple plays of the base game. But I'm now 7 plays into this system, and only won for the first time recently, by putting together a really solid deck that played well as both an offensive and defensive toolset. And it does seem like some players in my game groups win challengers more often than most, giving challengers more of a skill-based experience than a luck-based one. And you can grab the base game online for 20, maybe 25 bucks online with these. At this price point, I think challengers, Beach Cup, or the base game are no-brainers. For more of my tabletop content, check out my profile at www.meeplemountain.com. You can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at Justin Bell Says. That's JustinBellSays. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and roll some dice.
I love animals, all sorts, shapes, and sizes. And yes, even cats, who I'm forced to admire from afar as I'm allergic to them, which then somehow results in them wanting to play with me because I'm avoiding them. Cat lovers, please explain this to me. So when a board game has a cute animal theme, I'm immediately drawn to it and absolutely have to play it. Boop, published in 2022 by Smirk and Laughter Games, is designed by Scott Brady with artwork by Kurt Covert. Boop, a very thinky game for two clever cats according to its tagline, is a two-player game for ages 10 and up, one that plays in about 20 minutes. I mention the age here because I think kids younger than 10 can play this game, and I have with my 6-year-old niece. I'll explain the rules variation on that later in the segment. Boop, which fits in a small square box about the size of a personal pan pizza, comes with an adorable assortment of wooden yellow and gray cats and kitten pieces. 8 kittens and 8 cats of their color for each player. The kittens are smaller and have their tails raised, ready to pounce and play, while the cats are bigger and probably less likely to bother with any of that juvenile nonsense. The game also comes with this quilted fabric game board, which you can place on the bottom of the box cover when playing or on any other flat surface. The quilt, light blue with a cute fish skeleton print, is quilted into squares and represent the bed that these feline creatures are hopping onto. Boop is very easy to learn, but much like herding cats, can be somewhat difficult to master. The person who most recently pet a cat goes first, which means I will always be second player. Alas, the goal of the game is to line up 3 cats in a row, whether up, down, or diagonally. Players first start with 8 kittens, though. The 8 cats are out of play at the start of the game. Players take turns putting 1 kitten or cat later in the game at a time onto the quilted board. When 3 kittens line up, these kittens are removed from the game and they graduate into 1 cat, which is now in play for that player. Sounds simple, right? But wait, there's a clever extra mechanism that makes Boop oh so fun. When a kitten or cat is placed onto the board, it boops all the other kittens immediately around it, and they must move into an adjacent square, even diagonally. If there is no adjacent open square, the kitten falls off the bed and goes back into your supply. Oopsies! And by the way, kittens cannot boop cats, but cats can boop other cats and kittens. The game literally becomes a game of cat and cat. You need to get your kittens onto the board and line them up, but at the expense that these new kittens are just booping everyone farther and farther away on the board. A good strategy is placing your pieces so that they can block your cats from being booped, but maybe by the time it's your turn again, your opponent has booped your cat out of the way. Or you can just strategically position your cats to be booped into lining up, but that's usually easier said than done because your opponent is actively working to boop your cats away and remove potential lineups for you while placing their tabbies onto the board. There's really just so much booping. The winner of the game is the first person to line up 3 cats, or by having all 8 of their cats on the board at the end of their turn. Boop also comes with a family-friendly variation. This set of rules has you skipping, graduating kittens into cats, and you just play to line up three kittens in a row for the win. This is a perfectly suitable substitution for playing with small kids, but even for non-hardcore gamers, the original rules of the game is easy enough to learn and not at all overwhelming to play. At its core, Boop is an abstract puzzle with a very charming theme plastered onto it. The components are great, and the cat meeples are just delightful. Boop is puzzly, doesn't take up a whole lot of table space, and adds a catty mechanism to what could have been just a very boring tic-tac-toe game. Plus, who doesn't love booping small animals? I know I do. And that's Boop! This is Meeple Lady for the 5x. You can find me as Meeple Lady on all the socials or on my website, BoardGameMeepleLady.com. Thanks for listening, and may you get all your cats in a row. Bye!
Born and raised in Los Angeles, graffiti and street art could be found on nearly every street of my surrounding neighborhood. It was also prevalent in a lot of 90s shows and movies that I watched. But maybe seeing in person the 27 floors of an abandoned skyscraper in downtown LA that were covered in graffiti last month inspired my game choice this time around. But first, allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Geraldine, and I'm back as a guest contributor on the 5x to highlight one of my favorite roll and writes, Tag City. Designed by Robin David and published by Runes Editions in 2018, Tag City is a light to medium roll and write, where 2 to 4 players are drawing polyominoes and competing to be the best and fastest graffiti artist in the city. Players take turns being the leading graffiti tagger and roll a certain number of dice based on how many players there are, and then assign those dice to specific polyomino shapes on a shared center board. 6 polyomino graffiti tokens will be placed on the center board during setup, in a way so that during gameplay, dice will be assigned to one specific graffiti token and then chosen by players during their turns. In a turn, the lead graffiti artist will draft one die and draw its corresponding shape on their own player board, and then similarly, the other players take their turns. Once everyone drafts their first die and draws the corresponding polyomino, there will be one remaining die and graffiti token left for everyone to draw simultaneously. If you haven't already seen how Tag City looks, I'll mention here that the main area on the player board where players are drawing polyomino shapes looks like a grid, with 12 columns across and 8 rows down, and each grid, or thematically city, is colored with 5 different districts. Now, I'm not sure if that description painted an accurate picture for you, but if you look up the game following this review, you'll know exactly what I meant to describe. Only this time you'll have an actual visual for reference. Scores are based on when players complete their own columns, rows, and districts. On each player board, there is one higher value reserved for the tagger who completes that column, row, or district the fastest, and one lower value for any other tagger after that. To keep track of these scores, the fastest, most efficient tagger must announce that they did so and circle the higher value, while the other taggers cross it out and wait to circle the lower value when they finally complete it. At the end of the game, they'll tally all their circled scores from their player board. It's also possible to have multiple players score the higher value too. Players can tag anywhere on their board with common placement rules like not overlapping or not drawing off the board, and while they're more than welcome to draw a different shape or pass, it'll cost them negative points at the end of the game. Tag City's complexity falls somewhere between Silver and Gold and maybe the Ganshan Clever series. The center board and player boards have one side for beginners, which pre-assign polyomino shapes during setup, and a basic player board, and then another side for more experienced players, which allows for random polyominoes and districts that aren't so straightforward. Now, I fully acknowledge roll and writes aren't for everyone, but they typically come in small boxes, and a majority of the ones in my collection can be taught and learned in various settings. Tag City is no exception. It's in fact an affordable, small box game, and spoken from experience, it's playable during loud family parties and has been well received during a weekend getaway with friends after the kids have all gone to bed. The quality of the player boards means it travels well in restaurants and breweries. Even at the highest player count, it also shouldn't take more than 30 minutes to play. I will add, though, that there have been many, and I'm sure we all know that I do mean many, Roll-N-Rites that have been released since 2018, and can compete with Tag City in complexity, price point, etc. But Tag City's theme just makes it shine for me, and all those I've introduced it to. The artwork is colorful and cool, befitting of a graffiti-style game. If you have the opportunity to play Tag City, I'd recommend it as an appetizer to your game day. Again, this is Geraldine offering my thanks to the 5x for another opportunity to come on here as a guest contributor. If you want to see more of what this hobbyist plays, feel free to follow me on Instagram at toliveanddiceinla. Thanks!
Castle Itter, the second game of four in David Thompson's Valiant Defense series, stood out as something special when I first played it. It was a challenging solitaire experience, and it was unexpectedly meaningful, and it portrayed a strange conflict from the end of the Second World War that I knew very little about. I was struck by the care that David had put into connecting the game to historical accounts, effort that he also put into the other games of the series too. I highly recommend the companion booklets he has written, one for each of the games in the series. He describes how his design choices matched up with the historical inspiration, and he provides important historical context for a time that is only very recently out of living memory. The PDFs of the booklets are available on the designer's website at digitalcapricorn.com. You may know David Thompson already from other games he has designed. The popular Undaunted series with Trevor Benjamin, the abstract game War Chest, and has worked recently with Liz Davidson on an upcoming game called Night Witches, which I'm very excited to see. This game is set in a castle near the Austrian town of Itter on the 5th of May 1945 during the final days of the Second World War. It was used as a prison for Ehrenhäftlinge, or honour prisoners. These were mostly French prisoners whom the Germans considered powerful enough to be kept alive and also in good condition. Five of whom are named and represented in the game directly, and these prisoners' defence and safety are the reason for the whole conflict. The defenders were a strange mix. A group of US soldiers led by Captain Jack Lee. There was an SS officer, an Austrian resistance fighter, and a small group of Wehrmacht infantrymen led by Josef Sepp Gangl. And a single tank named Besotten Jenny with its four-man crew. This battle is sometimes termed the Strangers of World War II due to this unusual set of allies. A relentless attacking force of the 17th SS Panzergrenadier Division will lay siege to them using nameless silhouetted tokens that move along a network of tracks to reach the castle in this game. This intentional reduction of detail is in stark contrast to the historical detail given to the named and profiled defenders. While the abstract tokens are no less menacing, the contrast does feel meaningful. The gameplay itself is exhausting, both emotionally and also as part of a game mechanism. You get 5 actions each round, which feel like not nearly enough, and almost every action you take with one of your defenders will exhaust them. The exhaustion represents their uncertainty on what to do next, I guess. Because an action will let them recover, or a defender with the command capability can rouse a room of exhausted men. You can also spend actions to attack and suppress, operate the tank, move to a new location, and in one ex-prisoner's case, they can escape under the right circumstances. The enemy attacks are dictated by a deck of cards. If you manage to survive to the end of the deck, or until reinforcements arrive, you can consider that a win. There is a way to put a score to your win, but believe me, just making it through is enough of an accomplishment. After each set of 5 actions, 3 enemy cards must be drawn and resolved. The enemy can attack people, damage the castle walls, which will disrupt or even kill anyone in the room they hit, or add troops to the board, pushing further in towards the castle. No card is good. This means that positioning your invaluable commanders in the right places is crucial, as well as correctly pacing your defense. You have to handle unpredictable surges in future rounds while keeping the enemy advances manageable, because if any SS troop would advance beyond the end of their track and reach the castle, that's it, Game over, that's an immediate loss. What you can actually target on your turn is simple, as all spaces are color-coded. For example, enemies on red spaces can be aimed at by defenders on red spaces. You can attack and suppress forces, either immediately trying to take them out or to add tokens to try and stop new troops being added to the board during the enemy phase. There are no guarantees here either. Both actions are resolved by rolling dice to beat defense values, so clever play using the very few good attackers you have is required, along with making good use of the Besotten Jenny's powerful guns, before the Germans might blow it up. This is a tense and very engaging game, with a strong link to the historical battle on which it's based. If you're a fan of challenging solitaire games about well-researched and unusual historical battles, and if you like games that force you to keep many plates spinning at once, and if you can handle some dice rolls going against you horribly, then this game is very well worth the time to get into. This is Castle Itter, the strangest battle of World War II. My name is Ben Osteen, and you can find me at Mastodon at benosteen@wandering.shop. That's Ben Osteen, BenOsteen. Thank you.
Trio was a localized version of a Korean game called Nana. Nana was also reviewed by fellow 5x contributor Ruel in episode 139. Nana also means 7 in Korean. You'll know why that's relevant in just a moment. Nana and Trio were designed by Kaya Miano, and Trio was illustrated by Laura Michaud. Trio can be played between 3 to 6 players, ages 6 and up, in about 10 to 15 minutes. My aforementioned comments comparing Trio to Go Fish were half in jest. In Go Fish, you must ask your opponents for specific card values in order to complete sets of 4 of a kind. Trio has a similar but still different gameplay flow. Players are dealt 9, 7, 6, or 5 cards for a 3, 4, 5, or 6 player game, respectively. The remaining cards, there are 36 in total, 1 through 12, 3 of each, they're placed face down in the center of the play area. The goal of Trio is to be the first player to collect 3 trios, or 3 sets of the same number. 3 5s, 3 8s, 3 2s, you get the idea. The one number that makes a difference is 7. You can win the game immediately if you collect all 3 sevens. The sevens are gold and embossed, so you know they're special. On your turn, there's a couple of things you can do. Ask another player to show you their highest card. Ask another player to show you their lowest card. These inquiries can be asked multiple times, even to the same player. In addition to that, players have the option of flipping over one of the face-down cards in the center of the play area. Once 2 cards have been revealed through any of the methods mentioned, if they match, the active player could continue to flip over another card from the center, or continue asking questions of their opponents until something is revealed that does not match. Your turn would end, any revealed cards that are in the center will be flipped back face down, and all the cards that were revealed from players will go back into their respective hands. If you happen to reveal cards that allow you to make a trio between what's been revealed by the players, what's been flipped in the center, and what's in your own hand, you can gather up a single trio and place it face up in front of you. You were successful, but now your turn is over. While I did not think I was the worst shuffler in the world, I'd be lying if I said that on multiple occasions I did not actually deal trios into my opponent's hands, allowing them to just instantly make a trio. Yeah, I'm that good. And the trick of the 7 is that it's in the middle. Typically asking somebody for their highest or lowest card is not going to involve a 7, at least not at the beginning of the game, theoretically. And just a random tip that I'm only mentioning at random, not for any particular reason, is that when someone asks you for your highest or lowest card, if you have multiples of that card, you only show them one card. If somebody says, let me see your highest card, you don't show them that you have 2 11s. You just show them a single 11. If they ask you again, then you have to reveal your additional 11. The rules also mention a team mode. Full disclosure, I have not played it. However, it does seem interesting. There are no face-down cards in the middle of the play area, and the teammates' only form of communication is the ability to swap a single card with each other after the other team creates a trio. So I guess you'd have either, you know, 2 teams of 2, maybe play 2 teams of 3. I don't know. But the cards are dealt out evenly amongst all the players. So you can't talk with the people on your team and say, hey, what do you have? What do you, you know, here's what I have, here's what you have. But you can pay attention to what they're asking for. And if you have it, you have to wait until the other team scores, essentially. But at that point, you can swap between you and your teammate. Face down, you know, no discussion on what it is. And in hindsight, yeah, it's just 2v2. I can't imagine how 3-on-3 would work. But you could try it if you want. But this is in addition to one free swap you can make after the cards are first dealt and gathered up in everybody's hands. You're allowed to swap one card face down with your teammate at the beginning of the game before any team has made any actual trios. What you're basing that swap on, that I don't know. Most of the cards also have small numbers in the lower left and lower right corners, which are used for a spicy mode. In spicy mode, in addition to winning by just getting a trio of sevens, you can also win by getting a pair of connected cards. Connected cards are those whose sum or difference are seven. For example, all the fours have a 3 and an 11 on them, because you win by getting the 4 trio and getting the 3 trio or the 11 trio. To sum up my thoughts on trio, I'll just say this. Trio is now a game that goes with me pretty much everywhere. If there be at least 3 people there, I bring trio. It's a fun game at night where you can barely remember anything, like I'm projecting, and you're forgetting that you asked people for their highest card the previous turn, and it's the same highest card because you're sleepy. You don't remember that. So hilarity ensues. It's fun. Anyway, I'm Aaron from GameOfDeuce.com. Thank you for listening. Take care, stay safe, and be blessed.
You've been listening to The 5x, your monthly source for board game reviews. Follow us on Twitter at 5xGames. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/5xGames. Join our BGG Guild 2810. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts from. And check out our website at 5xGames.com. If you like what we do and would like to support our work, visit our Patreon at patreon.com/5xGames. As always, thank you for listening.
For more shows like this, check out the Goonhammer Media Network. More info at media.goonhammer.com.